By 1992, Japan's bubble economy had burst, and the 90s recession had begun. It is no wonder that Tokyo Babylon's middle gets dark. Moral relativism, joining cults, elder abuse, and the controversy over organ transplants were in the headlines at the time, and they find their way onto the pages.
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland. So, Robin, Volume 4 broke me.
Yeah, you definitely, like, were texting me about that.
I was prepared, and yet not.
It's hard to be, it's like, when somebody tells you something is going to be sad, you're like, yeah, uh-huh. You're like, yeah, it'll be sad, I'll cry. But, like, telling somebody what emotions they will feel does not tell them why they will feel them.
Yeah, well, and it's not like Clamp has not done this to me before, so I wasn't, like, surprised, but at the same time, I was, like, not prepared for the emotional reaction I would have.
Yeah, I think that by this point, it has really hit its stride.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they are actually able to get some real emotion out of you because the storylines are really thoughtful and the storytelling is really, really good. So I think that it can do some things more effectively than the sort of tragedies that you got in Rig Veda.
Yeah, and it's also because it's taking its time more, whereas Rig Veda, though longer, felt like a run to the end, which is one reason we talked about it the way we did. This definitely is taking these slow moments to build, where, like, it feels like you're going to have the rug pulled out from under you at some point, where it's just, like, building you up with this tension, and I know we're going to get to some shit in the next two volumes, I'm sure, but right now it's just, like, this slow build, and I love it.
Yeah, it's really good, and really, really sad. This is volumes 4 and 5,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, I'm calling the middle. 3 is probably, when it's 7,
yeah,
how do you describe what the middle is? It might be 3 through 5, but and it might be, like, I think 3 was the call A and B.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, I think that you can see where that would lead up to this, because that's the story with the girls that are kind of forming a cult of 3 that believe that they have superpowers and need to save the world, and Subaru tries to help them, and instead everything goes to hell because Seishiro gets involved and things are just awful.
Yeah.
And these volumes, there is a story in volume 4 about a cult, and I think it connects really nicely with that. So it feels like that leads directly into this.
Yeah, certainly. Both 3 and 4 have that format you kind of just described, where it's like a short story, and then it has, like, a two-parter that's a big story, and I think 3 was the same way, and 4 does that. Whereas I think 5 has more, like, short stories that aren't as connected.
Yeah, 5 is 3 specific episodes. I'm pretty sure that these correlate to what was published in the magazine, because it was quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that each one of, like, what we're calling an episode or a part, which have separate names and are treated like they have a beginning and end, like there's a little frontispiece and a little end piece every time you read them in these volumes. I'm pretty sure this is what was run in those magazines.
Mm. Yeah, I think of them as chapters.
Yeah, yeah. So volume 4 came out in 1992, and it was, of course, not the only thing they were doing in 1992. Rig Veda was still running. They launched a lot of other comics in 1992 and 1993, mm-hmm. including X, which this is sort of the prequel for. And it is interesting to me, I did not know this, but they ran simultaneously for a year.
Yeah, I didn't realize that either.
Yeah, it is going to blow my brain. So when we discuss X, which will be in a couple months, because there's some other things that came out that year before X got launched, I think that we'll try to tell you at what point in Tokyo Babylon they must have been at during the different volumes, because, of course, characters appear from this, they appear in that, and it is weird that that happens. Like, it is wild that that happens for reasons that we will discover soon, and it'll be interesting to see, like, how much was foreshadowed or not.
Yeah, well, in, I think, volume 3, they say, they give a year mark in that they say the apocalypse is in, I think, 7 years.
Yeah.
So that can give us an idea, maybe not when it was published, but at least, like, it is grounded in a specific time.
Yeah, it's contemporary.
Yeah.
It definitely comes up in these volumes that from the beginning of volume 1 to the end of volume 7 is one calendar year. Like, that comes up in the text of Tokyo Babylon. Mm. And I think it comes up in these two volumes. If it comes up in six, I'm sorry that I stargazed. So that might be a thing where you give me a stargazing check next week.
I need to have my list, Robin!
So I could talk endlessly around what happens in these volumes because I love them so much. But I think it'll be better if our discussions are more organic as we actually tell you what happens in them. But before we discuss what happens in them, it's time for spoiler warnings and content warnings.
Mm-hmm. So if you haven't read volume 4 and 5 and you do care about spoilers, this is your chance to pause, go get that taken care of, and come back. We'll be here when you're done.
Yeah.
And as we get into the discussion, we want people to be aware that there could be some triggering stuff here. There's going to be some dark themes, some references to violence, and I don't think we get to suicide in this first volume, but there may be references to self-harm and the like, so
yeah, you know, be prepared. There's definitely rough stuff, and we should have content warnings up on the website. That should be there already.
It should be in the show notes, too. Yeah.
Yeah. But still, like, general content warnings for all of Tokyo Babylon.
Yeah.
I don't think, again, that you should avoid it necessarily, but if you're in a place where you're like, I can't go there, don't go there right now.
Yeah.
Wait till everything's a little more okay.
Yeah, there were definitely I was reading this before bed, and there were definitely a couple nights where I was like, no, I can't. I know I'm gonna cry, and I can't do that tonight. I need to just go to sleep.
I love crying before bed.
Well, I just knew I'd stay up too late.
We're laughing about that. That's how we're dealing.
That's fine.
So volume 4 begins with a story called Crime. And all of the titles are in English in the original Japanese volumes.
Hmm.
But this one opens with like a dictionary definition of the word crime. But it's tsumi in Japanese, which also is a word used to translate for the concept of sin.
That's interesting.
And they do, even in the English, one of the definitions of crime is basically a definition of sin in terms of being, like, something that goes against religious doctrine.
Hmm.
So, kind of interesting, like, the theme of this, like, this story discusses the concept of what is a crime and what isn't a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those things kind of, like, follow us throughout these volumes, I think, too.
Yeah, which is interesting to note because Rig Veda had so much to do with sin, and now,
yes.
Now here we see this theme again.
And I think very much in Rig Veda it's sin.
Yeah, like sin,
like
sin.
A very spiritual concept of things that are bad on a level that the gods care about and that the stars care about. And that is not what this one... This one sort of like it touches there, but this story specifically touches on maybe the difference between what is a sin versus what is legally not allowed.
Yeah, and how one within society decides that.
Yes. So, where do we begin? Oh yeah, Subaru is adorably making up class credits.
Oh, yeah.
By drawing.
So cute.
Yeah, it's really
cute. Too much art class.
Oh, poor baby.
Poor baby. Too pure.
He's too pure. But he sees a shrine being torn down and it really bothers him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we get some nice conversation that I think is very much a part of the, like, era of this.
Mm-hmm.
About shrines being torn down to make up, you know, to make room for progress, for more buildings to be built. Tokyo was already getting built up so much. There's such limited land and everything could be redeveloped at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Kyoto, that still has so many sites that are just ancient, Tokyo has been completely leveled and rebuilt multiple times.
Yeah, this particular part reminded me a little of something you see on Miyazaki movies, where you've got this kind of, like, the old world sort of fighting for the new world, or fighting against the new world, or to survive amidst, you know, industrialization and such. And
yeah.
Yeah, just the specific part with the shrines, like, reminded me of something a little bit, like, Spirited Away, or...
Yeah.
Especially, like, Mononoke Hime, although obviously that's, like, a way earlier setting.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. I think that fits into this in an interesting way, because he stumbles across a woman doing something very wrong on these hallowed grounds, or these formerly hallowed grounds.
It's an interesting moment because we see Subaru have a much more, like, kind of aggressive reaction than usual.
Yeah, usually he's so gentle, and here he's, like, actually, like, what are you doing? Like, what have you done?
Yeah, like, you kind of see him kind of put on this air of authority when he sees what's going on, because she's just buried something, which we learn is a dog head that she has removed from its former owner.
Yeah, and he understands. He's not only upset because, as we've seen in earlier stories, he loves dogs. Mm-hmm. He's not just upset about that. It's he knows what spell this is, and he knows that it is a spell that, like all curses, it's a curse, right? Mm-hmm. That, like all curses, and it's not the first time we've heard this, and this was, of course, very important for the story in Volume 3, a curse that you send out will become reflected back on you. So he's trying to convince her not to go through with whatever she's doing, because he doesn't want her to get hurt.
Yeah, and she just does not care. And we learn that her daughter was kidnapped and murdered fairly recently.
Yeah, it was something in-universe. This was, like, in the news, and he had even heard about the case. And the murderer was caught and then let off. And the story is ambiguous about the exact circumstances of this, but she says that he was found to be, like, mentally ill, and so he didn't go to jail for it.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly what that was supposed to be, because there's a lot of different things that could happen there that could be interpreted that way by somebody who's upset about it.
Yeah.
But it's like, they don't tell you whether he is in an institution.
Mm-hmm.
She just feels like he's not being punished properly for this crime.
Yeah. And she's enacting this curse to send punishment upon him. And she has this logic where, like, since he got away on a technicality, what she sees as a technicality, she'll basically get away on a technicality too, because
magic isn't real.
Yeah, the curse did it, not her. And even she's like, why would anyone think that I could have done it?
Yeah, which I love. The magic isn't a crime. If a curse kills him, she'll be home free. But also that, like, she was going to just murder him, and she's like, I can't do that because I will then be a criminal.
Yeah. It's interesting that she would even kind of, because she says she doesn't care what happens to her, so it's sort of surprising to me that she wouldn't be worried about being, accused of murder. I suppose she was willing to go to that extreme if she had to.
Yes, and this seemed like a better alternative. It's that she feels like she would be seen as a criminal.
Mm.
She's not just worried, it's not so much worried about what will happen to her physically.
Yeah.
It's that she will be seen as a criminal, which is unjust for her.
Yeah, because she's trying to do what she sees as righting a wrong.
Yeah, this is justice. She is trying to take justice into her own hands. A crime was committed. No one was punished. She is so unhappy about this. Like, she can't. She has no life anymore. She has nothing left but this need for revenge. And Subaru can't handle that. Yeah. He sees this moment as being a moment where he should fix things. And so, why not channel the dead a little bit, since that's a thing he can do? And he is so certain, like, he can't stand seeing her suffer. He is totally certain that he is going to talk to the dead daughter and give her a moment of absolution, and the daughter will be like, oh, Mom, I love you, be happy without me, and then everything will be fine. Like, that's what he thinks is going to happen. She agrees to let him do this, mm-hmm. because if she is willing to believe that she can make an Inugami kill a man, she definitely also believes that this teenage boy can talk to dead people.
Yeah.
So he does it. He channels this little girl, and I think that Mom can see the ghost but cannot hear her.
Yeah. So she can tell that the daughter is saying stuff and is there, so she's got proof that he's not just crazy.
Yeah, it is very established between both of them that this is very real and very much happening, but it does not go down the way Subaru or anyone would expect it to.
Nope, and this is the part that broke me, because, the little girl basically saying, Mommy, it hurts. Mommy, make him pay.
Yeah, the child wants revenge. And I think it's an interesting thing to discuss here, where you're like, on the one hand, we really want to see children as being pure and unable to harbor the dark negative feelings that we don't like in adults, but children are really obsessed with fairness and justice.
Yeah.
And whether or not you totally buy that this is exactly what this little girl would think, there is that moment of, like, I'm hurting. You should make him stop hurting me. The idea that she is still in being tormented by what he did in the afterlife is a strong belief that people often have. The idea that her spirit is not resting because this was so bad, that maybe something really does have to happen for her spirit to be okay. That's a really difficult concept to deal with in your belief system.
Yeah, and I think you see that a lot with family victims who maybe for whatever reason have a similar thing where they don't see justice being done and they feel like, I need need this for, you know, closure for me, but also for, you know, my dead loved one. And it's interesting because I feel like there is kind of that, like, platitude of, like, oh, what would they want for you? They wouldn't want this. Well, maybe they would. Like, maybe they do want the horrible thing and they don't care what happens to you to accomplish it.
And he has talked people off of very proverbial ledges before by telling them that the people in your life would not want you to suffer and don't want you to have these negative feelings. He's used that line before, so he really thought this was going to work. He has this moment where he is listening to the ghost of a little girl talk about what she's going through and then also ask for revenge.
Yeah.
And he has to decide what to do. And so the pages here are him losing it while the little girl's ghost is crying at him and mom is begging him to tell her what she's saying. And he makes a choice.
Yeah.
This choice is a humongous turning point. And I'd say that volume 4 and 5 have many turning points. Like, this is the middle of this series. It is the pivot point on which the entire story turns from being sort of semi-lighthearted ghost of the week stories into something much darker and much deeper. Because he makes a choice.
Yeah, you can feel that shift in that moment, too. And the choice he makes is to lie to her and tell her the thing he wants to tell her, which is that, no, your daughter doesn't want revenge. She wants you to be happy. She wants you to move on. And this kind of breaks him.
Yeah. Like, we don't get a ton of, you know, like, she seems to have some amount of actual absolution here. Just getting to see her daughter again might have actually helped mom a little bit, but we don't get a lot of resolution for that story. He leaves and shows up at Seishido's apartment crying.
Yeah, because they'd established earlier that he was going to go there for dinner afterwards or whatever. And yeah, I love that Subaru is just so, like, hard on his sleeve. Like, he doesn't show up trying to hide that anything's wrong. He's just, like, literally crying.
He does show up and he says, I don't think I should have dinner tonight. I'm not having a good day. And Seishido's like, this is exactly the time you need to come in here and have a shoulder to cry on. And if there was ever a moment where you were going to be convinced that maybe everything is fine, this is the last moment where you can believe things might be fine. Second to last. There's one in volume 5 also.
Yeah.
But there's this nice moment here where Seishido hears him out, and he kind of comes to his rescue, right? Like, he sort of says the right things, where he's like, yeah, you probably did the right thing here, because if you... I'm like, what are you supposed to do? Tell her to go kill a man? Like, that's not the right thing. And maybe lying to her isn't what she wanted, but she will never know that you did that, and you did what you thought was right, and if it was right for you, maybe it was the only right thing to do here.
Yeah. It occurred to me, this may not be anything, but Subaru's way of helping people through stuff is very much just acknowledging their feelings and not making his own judgment statements.
Yes.
Seishido literally says, well, if you need someone to absolve you, I'm going to do it. I agree. I think you did the right thing. If you're wrong, I'm wrong too. So he's literally stating his own opinion, whereas Subaru's kind of MO is not.
he will either rely on what he has been taught or this very non-judgmental idea that everyone's, like, truth is their own and their suffering is their own and only they understand things. And I think that's why he's so upset. He says something like, I selfishly withheld the truth from her and kept her from possibly being happy just because it was what I thought was right. And of course, the happiness she would have found would have been in literally killing someone. And he is clearly correct.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, here is that you're like, the discussion, and they have a discussion about this, and this is one of those topics that there is no satisfying conclusion. This is still controversial. What is the point of justice and punishment? Is justice ever real?
Mm-hmm.
If someone kills somebody else, you're not bringing somebody back by killing the murderer.
Yeah.
And there are many, many arguments for stopping someone from committing more crimes, but if you don't have any evidence that that is the case, you know, like, that they're ever going to do something again, what are you doing? What are you asking for? Is the punishment to keep someone else from doing things like this? Is the punishment some sort of divine balance? Because that is a religious belief and not at all a physical thing you can prove.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the ultimate difficulty of people who are representing the rights of prisoners versus people people representing the rights of victims have this clash to this day. If you listen to any true crime stuff or you know anybody who works in the justice system.
Yeah, or well, any debate about whether or not to allow the death penalty at all comes down to that.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's really hard when somebody's family has been through an unbelievable tragedy that was at the hands of somebody else. It's hard to tell them that it may not be, it's not going to actually do anything real and physical to punish somebody else. At the same time, there are sometimes things that really can be done. If it was due to negligence or a bad policy, some things could be changed to stop the bad thing from happening ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice that they did not do a really long debate about mental health issues here, because there was no qualification in this. This story should not go there. Particular one, there's no good place to do that. And it's a really, that's an uncomfortable place, because in reality, people who have mental illness are more likely to be victims of crimes than perpetrators, but we have taught through pop culture and everything else, we have taught people to be afraid of people with mental illness and afraid of their own mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really squicky thing, and I'm kind of proud of them for not spending too much time on that aspect, because as much as I wish it had never been brought up there, like, they could have easily also had it be a teenager, because I know there's a big deal in Japan about how they do not like to put people in jail, and kids especially, they really do not put kids in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people who get away with pretty serious crimes because they are minors, and that is very controversial. But at least they didn't make a big whole thing about that. Like, they moved on very much more to talking about the victim's feelings and thoughts and rights here, which is I think that was the right move.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, and more what's going on too with Subaru is less the question of even, like, who decides crime, what is, you know, crime and what is society. It's really down to his decision to convey the true statements the kid was making or lie for his own moral decision.
Yeah, he's worried on some level that he committed a crime by lying, and the idea that that lie might be just as bad as something she did. There's some interesting moral relativism there, and this is stuff that is very hard to come to a distinct conclusion when you realize that people's belief systems are vastly different from each other sometimes.
And can be so affected by the thing that they have gone.
Yeah, if you've never gone through anything like this, it's really easy to say what you know must be right. But if you've gone through it, you're like, well, my perspective is very different.
Yeah.
And that is one of Subaru's main things that he says throughout all of this, is that, like, oh, your perspective is informed by your suffering. I have not suffered like you, so I don't understand you.
Yeah, and this is one where he's actually forced to make a judgment on that, because he has the power to do it, and it really will affect the lives of people. And
I think that's why it breaks him so utterly, that he had to make a definitive decision, and he doesn't like the one he made, but he also could not have made a different decision. Like, he could not have said anything other than what he did. And it's a really sweet moment. Seishiro kind of sweeps him off his feet and, like, kind of puts him to bed, and it's not super creepy. Like, there's a nice little thing where he's just, like, reassuring him, and it's so great until we get an aside from Seishiro where Subaru has already fallen asleep, and Seishiro breaks a mirror and says these words: "At this rate, I'm definitely going to win our bet." And you're like, cool!
Yay!
Thanks!
Did he break the mirror, or did the mirror break through his sheer evilness?
I don't know whether he broke the mirror with his glasses-less visage.
Yeah.
Or whether he punched it, but I seem to remember that he did something forceful to do it.
Okay, because when I was, like, flipping through rereading, I couldn't tell, and I kind of just decided that it just, like, goodness in the mirror detected his evil and just couldn't handle his stare.
And that's possible because mirrors are a thing you use to, like, reflect back a curse.
Mm.
So I would not disbelieve it, but I'm pretty sure he either punched it or closed a closet door too hard.
Yeah. That seems like more realistic.
Because I think that moment is supposed to be a reminder that the gentleness he just showed Subaru is belying a very dark strength that he also has.
It's a facade, or at the best, like, an alternate personality. I'm still not entirely sure. We'll get there.
It's somewhere in between.
It's gonna be good. So for the rest of Volume 4, we have two chapters that are Save A and Save B, which both deal with this cult that Subaru kind of infiltrates.
Yeah, sexy grandma tells him he has to do that. Like, that's that's the job that he's on, is infiltrating this cult.
Yeah, and
I think he's supposed to infiltrate it because they suspect that the person running it has actual spiritual power, and that is a thing that they're sort of, like, suspicious of and overseeing.
Yeah, they're, from what I got anyway, it seemed like they were concerned of kind of people who don't know what they're doing messing around with occult things, like in Volume 3 where we had the teenage girls with the kind of, like, apocalypse group.
She also, when giving him this assignment, though, has an entire long thing about the Sakonazuka Mori and telling him about kind of, like, prognostications or visions of the Sakura stealing him away, and she gives him this whole, don't let the Sakura seduce you, and you're just like, Grandma, this could have been actual relationship advice, and it would have been so much more helpful.
Yeah.
Because he's very, like, he knows, I think, at this moment, he knows that it might have something to do with it, but he just does not want to believe it. And there's very much, like, some cognitive dissonance, like, visible in his big anime eyes.
Yeah, it's like he's getting the message, but he doesn't want to get the message, so
yeah,
there's some denial going on.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful spread, though. It's like a two-pager that's him kind of surrounded by cherry blossoms, and he's wearing his own Myoji outfit, and it's very reminiscent of little him in the cherry blossom fields, but also, like, you know, it's clearly current him.
Yeah, and he is, like, unconscious and collapsed on these two, like, in this vision. It's beautifully drawn, and mm-hmm. it's also, like, a double-page spread beat with one line of dialogue and one character, and I am jealous of them for getting to do that, because it's not lazy, it's not taking up time, it's a really important story beat that is focusing your attention on this imagery that will repeat throughout the story,
mm-hmm.
and that might mean different, again, like, is this a prognostication, or is this just connecting it backwards? You don't know yet, and that's really cool.
Yeah.
They got to do a double-page spread! Anyway, I love it.
Yeah, their visual pacing is just amazing. Like, in this moment and in many others, they really know how to give importance to moments when they need to and move through moments when they need to.
Yeah, and taking time to do visual storytelling that could have been done much less elegantly in either narration, which there is none of in mm-hmm. this, or in dialogue, which you didn't need, there's beautiful visual storytelling. When we discuss everything that happens in this, we're always kind of taking away part of what's really good about a comic.
Yeah.
It's what's ridiculous about doing a comics podcast is that we're trying to tell you what these stories mean, but we're telling you words, not showing you pictures. And I think that that's why I want to make sure we bring up visuals whenever we can.
Yeah.
Because I really think that the visual storytelling is such an invisible art. Like, you look at how beautiful the drawings are, you may not know why they drew what they drew, but it's always for a reason. And especially in Tokyo Babylon, where it's so much more stripped down than Rig Veda and so much more focused, it's never a page where it's just somebody's face for no reason. If it's just somebody's face, it's purposefully there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's because that's the most important thing and that's what you need to focus on. So I really am excited to bring up a couple of those moments, and this was one that just, like, I've gone back to that spread a lot.
Yeah, kind of in the same way movies can never quite convey, like, internal perspective the way a novel can.
Yeah.
It's hard in a summary or in just prose to convey the kind of, like, mood that a comic can convey.
Yeah.
At least not in the same way, obviously. So, like, there's really something unique to the medium. I've always liked comics because they're kind of they're that step between, you know? Like, you've got the visual element and you've got the prose element and you've got your own internal experience with it where you're not watching it with people. It's not like watching a movie with people.
And it also doesn't have the linear moving through time thing that mm-hmm. movies have. A comic, everything is held in stasis, and movement is always just implied. So there's some really cool things with how time is, like, extremely, not only not linear, but it doesn't progress in anything like reality. You can have an entire page where there's 2 minutes worth of dialogue happening over a still image, and when you translate that into anime, for example, you will have ridiculous things where a character delivers lines while flying away, and you're like, no, it doesn't work, but it works visually in a comic perfectly well.
Yeah, or you'll have what has kind of become a cliche in parodies of anime, where you just have someone turn dramatically to the skyline and then monologue for a while, which you can do really well in comics because it's just a large page
with
that happening. And they're probably moving around if they were a real person or whatever.
But it feels like this important beat when you do that in a comic. And then the second things are moving around, you have to find other ways to make that a story beat in like a film medium.
Yeah, and that type of pacing, I feel, usually gets lost between manga to anime.
It's just hard
to convey. You have to, it's a different medium. You can't tell a story in a different way. And we'll talk about that more when we get to one of the series that actually has like an active anime. It's not just little one-offs.
True, because I could go on a whole thing about how it's not impossible to do, but it requires a director who understands what's important about what they're adapting and is willing to make the changes that help preserve what's important, as opposed to people who are just trying to put it on the screen and are not thinking about how to preserve anything. They're just straight up translating it. And anyway.
Weirdly, I feel like Chobits does this really well. I'm stargazing.
You're stargazing. Totally stargazing. Right,
but
this moment.
I still think the Chobits anime does that really well. And we'll find out in a few years.
It's going to be a while till we get to Chobits. While Lucy gives herself a check mark for stargazing, I'm going to talk about the story again. Because, okay, we have this, like, Subaru who has to go infiltrate a cult. Well, the thing about this cult is that he is not the only character we're following who is going to be in this cult.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of the story, we have a heroine who is being mercilessly, cruelly bullied at school. And her story is so much about how she is being blamed for it by every adult in her life. There is no one who is willing to hear out her side of it. Every time they tell her that it is her fault. She's like, you're not outgoing enough. You're not really trying to be their friends. You're not participating. And that is the attitude so many adults do have about bullying. And I think Clamp does an absolutely incredible job of showing you the bullying she's going through and how cruel and pointless it is and how she has no control. There's no reason for it. She has been a selected target. Like, she has been selected as a target by these girls. And there's no reason, and there's nothing she can do, and then every adult in her life is telling her to change herself, to be not bullied anymore, and she is losing it over how impossible and clearly wrong that is.
Yeah, and it kind of builds it well, too. Like, at first, if I remember correctly, you kind of just get the feeling that maybe she's a little bit of an outcast at school, but not, you know, being actively tormented, and then it kind of just ramps up the more instances you see, and you get that it's not just, like,
being left out.
Yeah, it's not just being shy and not getting along with the other girls and whatever. It's actually being, like, physically attacked by them.
Yeah, they have turned her, they have othered her and made her into a punching bag.
Mm-hmm.
And it is pretty clear that there is no reason for this. She is not being ostracized because of a physical thing. There is nothing about her that is actually different. They have just chosen her because she's kind of quiet and an easy target because she's not fighting back. So everybody is telling her what to do, and she can't do it. And it is just like, I don't know, it's beautifully done. And then a way too nice creepy church lady recruits her into this cult, promising her that she can save her.
Yeah, and in a very, like, too good to be true kind of way, that's like, we see what you're going through and we can teach you the strength and we'll give you the guidance to solve your problem.
Yeah, and I want to go on a big long rant about Japanese new religions, and because we're calling this a cult, and it's not a cult, it is a new religion. Not as in a lowercase new religion, but an uppercase new religion.
And yeah, I didn't know about this until you were telling me about it.
I want to go on a super long rant about it, and I think I'm going to cut it really short for today, and we'll come back to it when we talk about X, because we will have to talk about it with regards to X. But we should point out that there is ever since World War II, there is a phenomenon in Japan of these sort of cults just popping up, and they do tend to recruit lots and lots of, like, lonely women, and sometimes college kids who are willing to try new things, and they are often a mishmash of Buddhist, Shinto, Christian, usually super apocalyptic also, and occultism, like, all these things just sort of thrown together, and they are, like, it's so hard to ever talk about topics like what's a cult versus a religion. You know, is that determined by people in power or who? Like, who determines these things? But these have a reputation for being really dangerous in Japan for a lot of reasons. Really, we'll talk about this more later. And it's like, it's so uncomfortable because I have such a, like, very particular perspective on this topic, but it's one that I don't want to do damage to anybody who has lived through some experiences with this kind of stuff. I know people who have left their parents' religions, whether they are like organized religions or what we would call a cult. I know people who have left cults. So it's kind of hard to talk about without being disrespectful, because it's so frustrating to see something that is preying on people in moments of need. Mm-hmm. And that is what this story is about, is that this girl is in a desperate, desperate need for help, and somebody offers her help, and she is willing to take it. But
you would say that their new religion is not equivalent to, like, New Age here.
No, because New Age, organized New Age cults exist.
Yeah. Right? But that's not all of, like, that's not what the majority of, when people are into New Age stuff or specifically into, like,
these are not synonyms.
Because mm-hmm. at first when I was reading this, I was a little like, what are we getting into here? Because I, at various stages, have been pagan, and so I had some alarm bells go off in my brain about demonizing of that.
It, nothing to do with that. Okay. It's, it can coincidentally be that, but this has to do with charismatic figures leading groups of people with very specific belief structures.
Yeah,
that is
very...
not, that is, there are definitely groups that use pagan or Wiccan like thought mm-hmm. to do this, but that is not a synonym. Japanese new religions is not a synonym with like New Age or paganism or anything, like not at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because I mean, clearly in the story, it is not behaving as if he, you know, just found some nice, happy, nature loving people who are teaching him about stuff, but it's, well, not him, but.
No. This is a thing in Japan, and when I was there, we even were told, like, not to accept certain kinds of things from people who were handing them out. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, you might get pamphlets, don't accept them, those are cult leaders. The other side of this in Japan is that there is a lot of political recruitment that goes along with this, where some of these groups actually wield political power.
Hmm.
In a similar way to, like, Scientology here.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, like, getting money from people and using it to fund candidates who might go soft on them or might be unrelated, and the entire cult is just a front for political power. So this is a complicated, weird topic, and we could do an entire podcast just discussing this. I will not do that. we want to get back to, like, the story going on in here, but for any reader at the time, they would know exactly what a new religion was. Mm. Or maybe they wouldn't know exactly what they were at all, but this would be part of the cultural milieu that they just were hearing about every day. These would be on the news all the time. You might have an auntie who had joined one of these, and you're like, it's a little weird. Like, this is a part of everyday life.
Which kind of makes sense, especially, I mean, popping up after World War II, but also as we are entering the recession and people are kind of in more dire straits. And yes. In these volumes, we see more and in volume 3, we see more of the characters referencing the recession or referencing like housing crisis.
Yeah, I think around here, Clamp is really talking about the contemporary issues of their day. Like, things are dragged from the headlines. This story, they got a lot of interaction with because the bullying themes are really, really strong. Mm-hmm. And then how it's handled is beautifully done, but also the thing going on here, right, is that our heroine has joined this cult, and all they do is they tell her to pray more, and someday you will be able to love yourself and forgive your tormentors, and you'll just become godlike. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff sounds great, but it does nothing to stop her from being bullied.
Yeah.
And it is incredibly unhelpful. She is still being brutally treated by her classmates, and so it means that here's just one more adult in her life who isn't listening to her and is just telling her that it's her fault because she's not praying hard enough.
Yeah, like, it starts out as being supportive, but then comes around to victim blaming again, just like the other adults in her life, where they're just telling her she needs to change her behavior instead of addressing the actual action happening.
Yeah, and our creepy church lady does seem to have spiritual power. She claims that she actually understands how people feel, that she can sense how they feel, and that's part of how she's able to help them. And then, as we, the reader, are seeing things about this cult, we are suddenly given a strange perspective on one of these pages where we see Seishido's Shikigami in the background spying on them, and we get another piece of beautiful visual storytelling where we get this double page spread of the Shikigami flying through a Tokyo night sky to, you know, land on his shoulder and report back, and there's no dialogue, just his sneaky evil face. So we know that Seishido is also involved in this.
Yeah, it is a beautiful scene. It's so cinematic.
Yeah. So we know that Seishido is spying on all of this, but Seishido does not know that Subaru is supposed to infiltrate them until Hokuto just, like, casually mentions it. And we get this weird moment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange. Like, weirdly, this volume, as Seishido becomes more overtly evil in his actions, I started to be more okay with him being around them. And I think it's because we have earlier the part where he's offering so much emotional support to Subaru, and then we have this moment where you see him, and usually when you have a shot of Seishido, like, you, the viewer, we're seeing him be all evil and you're kind of getting his true emotions. And this time, like, no one sees this but us, but he is reacting with surprise and he looks concerned when he learns that Subaru is also investigating the cult.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment where you're just like, wait a minute, he doesn't know about this. What's he gonna do? Is it all gonna be okay? Like, is he really not trying to dog his steps here?
Yeah, and what does that concern mean? Is he really worried that this is gonna somehow mess up his plan? Because he doesn't seem like he's, like, professionally concerned. It almost looks like he's having a personal reaction of our worlds colliding or something.
Yeah, it looks very genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ends, like, save A.
Yeah.
Save B begins with Subaru and our heroine. What's her name again?
Kuniko Hashimoto.
Yeah, she's mostly referred to as Hashimoto because it's her classmates who are tormenting her, and they're mostly the people who are using her name.
Yeah, and Subaru calls her Hato-san. I think the only one who calls her by her first name is the cult lady, who's confusingly named Kumiko-sensei. And this is Kuniko-chan. And we're pretty sure it's because the kanji's probably wildly different, so it wasn't confusing when you were reading in Japanese. It is kind of confusing when you read it in English.
So I'm going to probably call her our heroine or Hashimoto-san.
But, yeah, I think that's fine. We don't know her.
Yeah, we don't know her. We'll be more formal. The cult lady pulls the two of them aside, and in a way that is sort of like, oh, I want you guys to get to know each other. You both joined recently. She kind of asks Subaru, like, what does he think about things? Like, asks maybe both of them what they think about things. And he's like, there's sure a lot of kids here. It kind of looks like a cram school, not a cult, you know? And this is, she does not call it a cult. She calls it the MS Research Institute. That is, and not as in multiple sclerosis, just acronym. But, like, no one calls it a cult in this. Yeah. It's just, I can't not call it
that. It's the easiest word, like, shorthand that we have to explain what's going on.
Yeah. And so she launches into this sort of, like, very canned speech about why it's mostly kids. And she's like, oh, it's because children suffer more deeply and purely than adults and aren't allowed to give up like adults. And so they need more help and they need a place like this to be accepted. And she says all this stuff and about how she wants them to feel like they can unburden their problems onto her. And she's like, it seems empathetic and it's so close to what Subaru offers, right? Like, it's not super different, but there's these subtle differences. And it's mostly that when our heroine, she does sort of lose it in this scene. Like, she actually tells the cult lady, she's like, the praying is not helping me. I'm still being tormented. Like, you have not done anything for me. I just want the bullying to stop.
Like, I found an adult and the adult's not fixing it.
But it's also interesting because here's a little girl saying that she wants her pain to stop, so much like the ghost of the child in the first story in this volume.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, Hashimoto's in high school, but yeah, like, just because people can't necessarily see.
She is a little girl to me because I am 33 years old as of recording
this. Well, see, I'm 32 and thus I am still quite youthful.
Yeah, I worry about her, though.
I worry about her, too. I just didn't want us to get confused in how literal of a... She's not the same age as the little ghost girl. That was very much like an elementary school child.
And the cult lady doesn't really have much of a response to this other than sort of like...
Yeah, she gives her the same, like, keep praying harder.
Yeah. Bullshit. And really, like, really emphasizes the idea that she should learn to forgive her tormentors. And our heroine just being like, I need the torment to stop. I can forgive them all day long, but it's still happening to me. What does that do for me? Mm-hmm. And this really reminds me of the victim blaming culture that is so hard to think outside of, because even though so many of us are victimized in our daily lives by a shitty patriarchal white supremacist system, we still see ourselves as being ones who just aren't strong enough to make it through. You know, like, we really can't handle the idea that a victim doesn't deserve it.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's sort of how we treat mental health as well. Like, we touched on it earlier, that it's victimized in a similar way, where you are just not strong enough to overcome your depression or your anxiety or your, you know, the voices that you are hearing. Like, we obviously have a tendency to victim blame, but it's kind of interesting that they're pulling these two parallels.
Yeah.
And we saw that a lot in Volume 3, too, with a lot of the girls who were involved in that little kind of occult group were because they were alone, and either, maybe, I don't think anyone was being, like, overtly bullied, but I think one of them was
one was being overtly bullied.
But at least they were not fitting in their groups.
Yeah.
They were not in, like, comfortable social situations.
Yeah, that was a story where people who were being ostracized were turning around and trying to empower themselves by doing something that wasn't actually good.
Yeah.
And it wasn't demonizing them for having those feelings, it was just telling them that that was not the proper way to handle this. And here is a story where you have a kid who is doing nothing to fight back yet, either, right? The idea is that, like, we have removed any concept of inappropriate action on the part of a victim, we're able to see her fully as a person who is just being victimized. And I think that's really helpful for them to discuss that tendency that in schools there really is a tendency for adults to tell kids you need to do X, Y, and Z to avoid getting bullied, as opposed to telling the bullies to not do that anymore. Yeah. Like, that we really want to believe that there is something wrong with this kid. Well, you're being bullied because you're standing out in a way that of course people should bully. It's weird how much that actually gets reinforced. And I mean, you know, like, I was bullied severely throughout all of my childhood, and I did get that story a lot. Like, that was a perspective I was given, where it's like, well, if you just did X, Y, and Z differently, they wouldn't pick on you. Mm-hmm. I was also lucky to have people in my life who did not put it that way, and to have people in my life who were very clear that was like, you need to persevere because what's going on with these people is that they are taking out their pain on you, which is generally what's really happening. But that turns into victim blaming also, where if as a victim, all you're doing is seeing things from the perspective of your torment, forgiving your tormentor, you're not stopping yourself from being, you're still, nothing is stopping the problem.
I feel
you're
like
not being helped.
The only time a conversation about forgiving them could be useful is afterwards. Like, when it is no longer an active problem, when you're trying to, like, recover from that, then, yeah, sure, you can talk about moving on and forgiving and forgetting, or however that helps you. But in the moment, that's not helpful at all, because that's not gonna do any good.
Yeah, and I will say that, like, I have not yet begun my therapy journey, but I'm trying to do that this year, because that particular thing, like, here's where we're getting really personal, this is not the only time that Tokyo Babylon is going to be incredibly personal for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a personal thing in general. It's not, it doesn't mean to me what it means to you, but it hits all these notes, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's going deep.
But there's a thing about spending so much of my life seeing everything in my life from other people's perspectives.
Hmm.
Like, trying to not judge the people who hurt me and hate them, and instead being like, oh, they came from a terrible background. They were being abused. Like, they were having it so much worse than I was. And then all of a sudden, my story is out of my control completely. It's very hard to figure out. Like, there's nothing wrong with me having that empathy for these other people and understanding what they went through and why they did it. But if I'm going through all of this, I am expending so much energy understanding other people who have never bothered to understand me and who hurt me. There is some weird stuff that happens in your head about it being your fault. Again, back to this idea, I think it's why I'm so fixated on discussing this. It's also literally the theme of this story.
Yeah, we've not gone too far off.
yeah. But the idea that, like, it's not your fault you were being victimized. You are not being and bullied, right? Like, it's not like you are so bad that you have to be nailed down. It's that we have all of these there's just some bad social machinery that we've got to get rid of that teaches children, whether they you mean to do it or not, that you should find the people who are other and stop them from being. And if you can't find one, make one, because that lets you create a social hierarchy that lets you stand on top of them and elevates you, which is definitely what's happening. Full disclosure, that's what's happening in this story. She is not a different ethnicity from them. She is not a different weight. There is no physical characteristic that they can really pick on. It's just a social hierarchy problem.
Yeah, like, she's not coded in any way for us to, like, understand at a glance why she would be picked on. Not that anyone obviously deserves that, but she's not given a telltale, like, I don't know, thing that would attract bullying, yeah, specifically.
It's not a specific kind of systemic oppression. It's more of this terrible, like, method of social control that's going, yeah, on here.
And while obviously no one deserves to be treated that way, by using a character that looks, from an outside perspective, you know, like they could easily fit in with the group and be unremarkable, it drives home just how unfair those choices are always, and yeah, how useless the advice she's being given is to her. Like, there's literally nothing she can do to change it, even if she, like, changing herself would actually help any, which probably,
yeah,
wouldn't.
Yeah, it's like, it makes it even clearer that that is not the right way to do this. The bullying is definitely escalating at this point in the story, and Subaru manages to... He doesn't save her from it. Like, he does not show up and rescue her from bullies. He's a little too late for that, but he sort of, like, picks her up after she has fallen, and she slaps him. Like, he reaches out to her, and she strikes back at him, and it draws blood on his cheek in that very anime moment, mm-hmm, of a small scratch on your cheek.
Small, like, dramatic scratch.
Yeah, yeah. But he does not react at all. He just gives her a handkerchief to clean herself up, and they end up having this conversation sitting around on the swings, and it's like such a normal kid friendship moment of, yeah, like talking through the worst things in your life in a public park in a place that feels like childhood, right? Because, yeah, you're sitting on swings and you're very equal because you're sitting down together, so there's no like height difference,
and you're not necessarily looking at each other. If you're both on swings, you're kind of looking forward, which makes it a little easier to talk about things sometimes when, yeah, you have to look someone in the eye.
It's really beautiful, and she talks it out. And here again, Subaru's major superpower is he listens to women, right? He just, like, shuts up and lets girls talk about their problems. But she really lets it all out, and including bringing up that she's like, yeah, all these adults are saying, well, it's just kids fighting, but this is gang violence. Like, they beat me up. They're doing these things. It's escalating, and no one is trying to help her. And she talks about how frustrating it is to be told that she should be praying more, and it's just not working. The cult says if she loves and understands herself, other people will love and understand her, and that's clearly not happening. And Subaru saves her life, basically, by saying something that she's never heard before, and it's not good advice. He gives her no advice. He just says, wow, that's so much. I don't know what to say because I have not experienced what you've experienced and I do not fully understand it. So there's no, I have no idea what to say right now, but wow. Mm-hmm. And she thanks him.
Yeah, and speaking of a moment of good visual storytelling, like, the image of her relief and thanking him is large. Like, it's not like a small panel, like, it takes up space.
Yeah, it would be easy to miss what that moment means if you're just reading through the dialogue really quickly, because you're like, that doesn't make sense. Why is she thanking him after he said nothing? And you're like, no, she is relieved because for the first time, somebody took her seriously and admitted that they don't understand her, admitted that they don't feel her pain. Because this lady, this cult lady, is telling her, oh, we understand your pain. Here, do this stuff that isn't going to help you, making it clear that she doesn't understand her at all.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's being gaslit. It's everybody, yeah, telling you, yes, we know what you're going through. Do this bunch of bullshit and you'll feel better. And it's not true. And to not feel listened to or not feel heard, it's just too much.
Yeah, and just the fact that having that acknowledged and, you know, being able to actually really talk to someone and have them listen is kind of what makes the difference for her, to kind of, it allows her to maybe realize or acknowledge that it's a real thing. It's a legitimate problem. She's not crazy. She's not just, you know, going about it the wrong way and misunderstanding, and, like, it is legitimately horrible.
Yeah, for somebody else to take it seriously means the world to her.
Yeah.
And she cherishes this handkerchief that he's given her. Like, mm-hmm, we see this in other scenes later, and it's so sweet, it's so great, except that it leads into the denouement of the story, where she is in art class and she's painting and the other kids are like, oh, it's so good. Pity if I screwed it up, right?
Yeah.
And they go through and they, like, ruin her painting, and then they ruin the handkerchief. Like, they get the handkerchief in the oil paint and she loses it because this is a precious object to her. And she, like, wrestles one to the floor. She finally fights back in a way that adults often tell bullied kids, well, just fight back and it'll all be over. Well, she fights back and the other girl fights back harder.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of the other girl being shocked out of this bullying moment, instead of the other girl being like, wow, she fought back, I didn't expect it, I guess I respect her now.
Yeah.
The other girl stabs her in the eye with a palette knife.
Yeah.
Which is our first clamp eye loss.
Yeah.
Which we are going to keep a tally of. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we should do with this, but this feels significant.
It does. I think we believe we've had one lost limb so far back in Rig Veda, and this is our first eye. It's very momentous.
They are very symbolic in clamp works, and they're often symbolic of different things per series, like, and often very, like, overtly this is a thing they are using on purpose. In this one, I think there's a little bit more of it, like, it's a little more subtle in mm-hmm. Tokyo Babylon right now. It becomes less subtle later on when it's, like, very clear. Am I getting stargazing for that?
I don't think so.
Yay!
I'm gonna let you have that one because you didn't mention anything specifically.
I didn't.
This scene, though, was interesting to me because as it was kind of ramping up, I expected, and at first I thought that Hashimoto had been the one who grabbed the weapon and that she was gonna, like, murder this girl and end up being just crazy and sent away, or, you know, either, like, literally driven mad, or just, you know, her life would be ruined by this act of violence that, you know, she was kind of pushed to, which would have been an interesting parallel with the previous one, actually. But instead, it goes the where she does the things she's supposed to do, like you said, but she ends up being the one who suffers for it.
Yeah. The idea that there isn't actually a way to fix an oppressive situation that's where you have no power. The power differential is that she has none,
mm-hmm.
and there is nothing she can do to change and shift that, because it's so much bigger than her, it's so much more systemic than just two girls fighting. Like, this other girl is physically stronger than her, and the other girl has already othered her, has already called her a ghost and laughed at her and pushed her out of her games. This, she has already decided that whatever she does to Hashimoto-san is fine.
Yeah.
And I think that she's so shocked she's fighting back that she feels like she has to defend herself, but she doesn't defend herself. She goes for blood.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to defend yourself from wrestling with stabbing.
Yeah.
That's more than defending yourself. And I think that, like, that moment, I mean, that moment is just chilling, and Subaru finds out about it after the fact from the cult lady who's called him in, and he thinks she's going to confront him about infiltrating the cult.
Yeah.
But no, she tells him about what happened to Hashimoto-san, and she describes her as being weak. Mm. She's like, oh, she was too weak, and, you know, she just wasn't strong enough to do what she was supposed to do, and this whole thing happened, and Subaru loses it again.
Mm-hmm.
He stands up to her.
He shuts it down.
He shuts it down, and it is the most confrontational and angry we have ever seen him. Like, ever. Like, more confrontational and angry than he was when he was just being really assertive about maybe don't do curses by
yeah.
killing dogs.
Yeah.
Like, he is really, really, like, there's fury in his face here, and we're like, what is he gonna do?
Yeah.
I mean, he says, you haven't suffered like her. How can you say she was weak and didn't try hard enough? You don't understand anyone's pain. You can't save anyone. And we're like, seriously, what's he going to do? Like, he has powers. What?
Yeah, you do have that moment where you kind of remember, like, yeah, he's our wonderful, sweet baby puppy Subaru, but he is also, like, crazy powerful?
But we never get to find out what he would have done.
Nope.
Because Seishiro enters the scene, magic knocks him out, very much saying, like, you should not see what's gonna happen next.
Yeah.
And he confronts the cult lady, and all he says is, like, I'm here because potentially you could make this into a cult with, like, 3 million members by 1999, and we just can't have that. I don't really care, but people just can't have that. And she questions him, and she's so terrified. She's like, who are you? Who sent you? What's going on? He doesn't answer. He just kills her. And it's kind of an abstract killing. Like, we see Sakura blossoms almost, like, sweep her away.
Mm-hmm.
And it is terrible, but it leads into, like, the darkest thing so far. Like, the darkest, creepiest moment that he has ever had. Like, creepier than when Subaru was, like, sleeping in his house, like, sleeping off being sad about lying in his house. He goes full creeper here. He leans over our unconscious Subaru and, like, peels back his glove a little bit.
Yeah, it was unsettling. For being such a small action, like, they have driven home the fact that Subaru doesn't even take off his gloves around his sister. Like, he sleeps in them entirely because she just bursts into his house or into his room. Like, they've very, like, not overly obviously, I mean, they're clearly hinting at stuff, but they've definitely mentioned throughout the previous volumes that he does not take off those gloves, and his grandmother has made sure that he does not take off those gloves. We know that those gloves are important.
But it feels so, it feels like such a trespass. It's like, not intimacy, it's rapey.
Yeah,
for him to be, like, peeling it back a little bit, and he only peels it back a little bit, and we get a spell reaction. And Seishiro's all like, oh, out of respect for your grandma, I'll hold off here. And you're like, oh, dear. And then the last spread of that sequence is so terrifying because you have Seishiro without his glasses on just, like, pawing at Subaru with his hand on his throat, basically just saying, like, oh, you know, like, we're getting so close to the end of the bet, but I'll hold off. And just this, like, it's so clear he's so predatory.
Yeah.
He's so predatory. And there's that moment of just being like, wow, he is so in control of this, and Subaru has no idea that's happening at all.
Yeah.
But we, the reader, know.
And I think that's the one that's a visual callback kind of to that scene we had earlier where Subaru was, you know, lit with the sakura blossoms and in his onmyoji outfit and the kind of two-page spread. This has a very similar composition but sort of flipped, where instead of Subaru kind of like looking downwards, he is on his, he's upside down and Seishiro's like looming over him. But he has a very similar like composition in his face and everything. And so it's a very like, they feel like very parallel images.
Yeah. Subaru never knows any of this happens. He doesn't remember any of this.
This is just for us.
It's just for us. But he does go visit our heroine in the hospital, and she doesn't let him in. But they have a conversation, and she looks remarkably okay. She doesn't look great. She's got a bandage over her eye, and she's in a hospital bed. But she's remarkably okay with the situation. And she's like, hey, I think that I can find the strength to face you eventually. I believe I can do that. Nothing the cult lady was ever saying made me feel good about myself or made me feel like I could ever find any strength. But what you said did make me feel that way. And I want to someday be able to think and give you the handkerchief back. And he gets it. It's really sweet. Like, he gets it, and they sort of do a, like, it's a date kind of thing. Like, I'm not sure they use that exact language, although Hokuto and Seishiro make a big joke about that.
Yeah, I don't think in any way you were supposed to feel that there is any romantic thing going on here.
There may be from her point of view. Like, I think that there was a little bit of her having a crush on him, but it is not the important focus of this.
Yeah.
The focus of this is that he, in not claiming to understand her better than he did, was able to give her some semblance of trust.
Yeah, yeah. It did not feel like a love interest approacheth.
Yeah. It was much more of like, oh, you have actually helped this person. You have done something significantly great for this person. And that's where volume 4 ends. Unfortunately, this is Robin from the future busting in to shut this down. We're gonna have to break this episode up into two, just like we had to do before. Unfortunately, we didn't realize we had to do that before Lucy went off to do pirate stuff all week, having a big, crazy outdoor festival experience. So I'm at home working, but she's out having fun. So it comes to me to give you the bad news that this episode is going to be abruptly over right now. But we will resume our discussion of the next volume in 2 weeks. As usual, you can find us on Twitter at ClampcastPod. You can find our Facebook page and our Facebook fan page. I think those are two separate things. It's Clampcast in Wonderland. And of course, our website, clampcastinwonderland.com. We are also, this podcast is available pretty much anywhere that you find podcasts, which is super exciting, especially because I'm listening to an awful lot of them myself right now. So I'm just like, oh, look, I'm here among all these luminaries. That's actually terrifying the more I think about it. Lucy should definitely not leave me alone to record these all by myself because I get really, really existential, which means it's important for me to remind you all that everything is definitely going to be all right, and try not to lose an eye.